What makes it so difficult to leave a toxic relationship? This is one of the questions I'm most frequently asked. People want to know, why can't those trapped in a narcissistically abusive relationship just walk out? In this episode, we're going to discuss what are the underlying dynamics that make it so challenging to end a toxic relationship. Hello, I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy, a clinical mental health specialist and also a narcissistic abuse survivor. Thank you so much for joining me today on Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. Be sure to subscribe so you're notified of upcoming episodes, and thank you for leaving us a review and letting us know how we're doing. This is a listener-supported podcast, so consider donating the cost of a cup of coffee to help support us. So let's listen in to this replay of a TikTok Live. Lately, I have been getting a lot of comments about why people get into narcissistic abusive relationship. There's pervasive sense or belief about what is a typical victim, what their makeup is. And then as a result, they tend to also then have this judgment about victims. It's very easy then for them to dismiss their problems as their fault because they got into this. They knowingly made this decision. Where did this myth come from, and what is actually the truth? So I'd like to spend some time with that today. And then the other thing I'd like to talk about today is a lot about what cognitive dissonance is. I know it's such a nebulous term, but I want to really dig into it with you. I want to actually help us begin to see the duality, see the degree that we're struggling with what's real and what's not real, so that maybe this becomes clear what it is. Because here's the thing. If you want to break the trauma bond, which is why we can't leave these toxic relationships, we need to resolve the cognitive dissonance. They're actually connected. It is the confusion and the inability to know what's real and not real that keeps us then trapped in these toxic relationships. To get free means we need to resolve, understand cognitive dissonance. I have a webinar coming up, Why Can't I Just Leave, which is about cognitive dissonance, which is why I'm spending a lot of time on it today, because I think this webinar, honestly, guys, even if you're out of a toxic relationship, this webinar is going to explain so much and it will help you in your healing journey. I think it's essential. I think it's essential part of our journey. And it's written by Dr. Kristen Milstead, a sociologist who got into a pathological love relationship like so many of us do. And she does what she does, which is she's a researcher. So what she began to do is begin to really do all this intense study into what happens in the mind of the victim, as well as in the mind of the abuser, to cause us to get trapped. And then to cause us mentally, how many of you know that even after you leave the relationship, you continue to be mentally preoccupied with that relationship as you try to make sense of what happened? Why did it happen to me? What did it mean? Is there something wrong with me? All of this, that's cognitive dissonance that you're struggling with. And that's why you're not able to sort of move on into the next phase of the relationship because it's keeping you trapped. So this webinar, which is August 18th, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, $25 replays for anyone who buys a ticket is for free. It's going to be essential part of your healing. And I would love to see you there. What is a victim? One of the things that you probably have heard it said about you, probably have someone has said to you, hey, it takes two to tango. If you got into this relationship and it went wrong, then probably you need to take a long, hard look at yourself and figure out why you got into this toxic relationship. How many of you have heard that? I've heard that. I've heard that multiple times. I've had many people over the years tell me that. Did you know actually that's not true? It came, and I can't even tell you where it came from. It came from early, like the maybe 1960s to 1980s, when domestic violence shelters were getting up and they were seeing this population of people coming in needing help. And they began to look at their personality types and they noticed a sort of a trend. And the trend was these women, primarily were women, were codependent. In other words, they had come out of some kind of addiction relationship or a family with addiction problems, or they tend to be really easygoing, compliant, and people-pleasing. And so as a result, they sort of said, maybe that this is what makes these people vulnerable, is that they're so easygoing and they lack boundaries and they have low self-esteem and they came from a troubled home. So the familiarity and the inability to protect themselves made them at risk to put them into the next relationship. And that's why they got into this toxic relationship. Now, here's the fascinating part. Sandra Brown actually got to hear her speak, said, no one researched this question. This question just came out of observation, anecdotal material only. There was no research conducted to say, is this a true assumption or just just based on slim population and we don't really have a good, you know, we don't have a really good subject base. They didn't ask. For 30 years, that perception persisted, was written about, put in books, all of that, and no one researched it. Sandra Brown realized that there was no research into this topic, and in 2014, she did this massive study in Purdue University. She did this big study of pathological love relationships, and she was particularly looking at psychopaths and their relationship with women. There were a few men in the study, but primarily the victims were women. So she talks about it gender-specific just because her research is just gender-specific. Would you believe she found the myth was wrong? It was wrong on two levels. One, they're not looking for troubled people for a partner. They're actually looking, in fact, she does groups with psychopaths and they told her this. It not only was observed by the study, but it was actually observed by their report. They told her they're looking for someone who's going to not believe that they could be who they really are, that believes in the goodness of humanity, a person who's a good team player, who it really believes in working things through, somebody who has integrity when it comes to a relationship and wants to stick things out. They want to find someone who's cooperative and loyal, all the things that would make you and I a really great teammate, a really great job candidate, a really great parent. All these qualities, the best qualities, determined, disciplined, loyal, agreeable, cooperative, all these things, those traits were elevated in these women before the relationship. They were hardwired into these women, and it's part of their personality. It had nothing to do with past. They gave these women an ACE. I don't know if you've heard of that. That's an assessment of trauma, if you had how much trauma you've had in your life. They didn't. They didn't have trauma. They assessed what kind of homes they came from. They came from normal homes, not a troubled home. They assessed for other problems in their lives. They were healthy, normal women. They did not present like this picture that has been perpetuated for 30 years. What they had that was different about this group of women than the average population is on two metrics on the big personality tests, like five factor, I always say it wrong, other big personality tests. They gave them several of them. They showed high on two traits specifically. They showed high on agreeableness, which is also known as cooperativeness, and they showed high on conscientiousness, which is also seen as loyalty. So these people have self-integrity. They stick to plans. They're goal setters. In fact, she found, as she looked at these women's professions, that many of them had high standings in their society, that they had been highly functional women, done really great things. They were doctors, lawyers, professors, judges, psychologists. They had gone on and done really well in their lives, that these traits actually helped them to do well, go well, and that this was the group that narcissists and psychopaths were deliberately targeting. They look for it. They're actually grooming them ahead. They're like scanning, looking for this group. And then when they meet you, they do some test questions to sort of see whether or not you fit the profile or not. And then based upon your response, that's when whether they move forward or not. So that makes me pause and ask, why then is this myth perpetuating? What's the benefit of the myth? Well, I think the few things. One is, I think that none of us like the idea that there are people trolling the population like shark. I don't think we like that. That makes us very, very uncomfortable. I think we want to keep ourselves safe, so we're looking for some thing that we can identify. And if we can say it's a flaw in the person, then we can say, I'm not like you. So this isn't going to happen to me because I'm not like you. I think another reason is I think abusers like to perpetuate. Anyone who's kind of high on these traits, they like to say it is the victim's fault because that exonerates them from responsibility. So when you see particularly more aggressive men and women say these things, I think they're victim blaming because it means that we won't look at them and hold them responsible for their behavior. We're going to hold the victim responsible for their behavior. It allows them to hide. It allows them, us not to address it, allows them to hide. I think the other thing is that we really struggle with our own inherent weakness, our own shadow side of ourselves. And so that when we see people that we think are weaker or maybe are not like us, we tend to they tend to make us uncomfortable. And instead of seeing that as being triggered around our own issues, we then project out our shame, our angst, our uncomfortableness onto them, and then make them the issue instead of addressing it within ourselves. So those are some reasons why I think we do it. But here's the interesting thing is, even when I present, it's funny, even when I present videos and I present the research, it still gets backlash. I just find that intriguing, and I'd love to know what you think. One of you asked, what is the test questions that they ask in order to know whether or not we fit that group? Well, they usually listen really careful for your history. They want to know, they're looking for a couple things. They're also, by the way, looking for people who are in a vulnerable section of their life. We all have vulnerable sections in our lives. That's not a bad thing. Don't feel shame that you have vulnerability. Right now, my sister passed away a month ago. I'm in a vulnerable state. I'm grieving. So I feel this big hole in my life. And so this would be time for me to make a note. Don't go dating because I may look for someone to somehow fill that in, that loss of her in, which is what happened to me, why I met the last guy, because I went right out after I was widowed and I began looking. And he knew that. He knew I was a widow. He was looking. He told me, looking for a widow. So they do that. They look for people who are in transition. So if you move across the country, you're starting a new job, maybe something happened in your family, there's been a big loss, all these types of things make you more vulnerable, make you possibly a better candidate. So they're looking for that transition, you in a transition. The other thing that they'll do something that will do a test, a test question. They'll put you in a position to where they'll see how agreeable and whether or not you allow them the control or not. Like the way mine did it on our first date was we were walking to the beach. There was a lot of stuff to carry down to the water. He insisted on carrying all of it and not letting me carry any of it, and then said someone needed to take care of me now. Now that sounds nice, but see, it was a test question of whether or not how much would I push back or not. Was I going to let him have control? He's a stranger. It's my stuff and he's taking control of my stuff. Was I going to let him do that? There was another moment in our date that he tested me that I realized later, looking back, that it was test, is that he controlled the floor of the conversation, probably talked 60 plus 70% of the time. The few times I talked more, he said that I was stubborn and that I talked a lot. And instead of challenging him and instead of just walking away and saying, no, I'm not interested in this relationship, I just backed up, you know. Women, unfortunately, have been trained to sort of tolerate this kind of behavior, and I did that. I sort of backed up and let him control the narrative, which then said that he would get to control the narrative of other parts of our relationship. So just be aware those types of things. Sometimes they'll ask you vulnerable things like, are you living alone or do you have a dog or things like that. Those can be test questions too, to see how vulnerable you are, to kind of resources. They may ask what your friendships look like. Now, here's the other thing that really freaks people out. Okay, so the mask is being created as they meet you and learn about you, and they're in the moment doing that, and then they're testing you by asking these test questions. Then what the hell are we supposed to do when we meet people? Do we not say anything about ourselves at all? I know that becomes the big concern. Well, obviously, you can't start a relationship and not share something about yourself, right? You have to. So what do you do then? Does that mean then me just don't meet anyone new? I think what it says to me, this is how I'm thinking about it, is I really need to get good at knowing my gut and what to me indicates when I've possibly met somebody who's toxic. That how do toxic people in the past make me feel? I need to learn to pay attention to that. Do they make me feel edgy? Do I feel more insecure? Do I look for their approval? I have to begin to really assess the way that my body and my mind and my emotion feels when I'm around them. And that can be a really, really great tool. Psychologists, by the way, therapists are taught to do that in the office. I don't know if you knew that. When you come in, we're assessing how you make us feel. So if I have somebody who kind of makes me angry, I know this person is very defensive and very aggressive, and that will put my back up. And that tells me something about the patient. Doesn't mean I get to react. I don't. But it does tell me something about the patient. If I have a client who comes into the office and I feel super sleepy and very bored, I know I have a client who's not talking about the things that we should be talking about. They are avoiding the very vulnerable things. And as a result, it feels like chit-chat and it's not deep and it's kind of not interesting. So that means I need to challenge them to get into the stuff that they're scared to talk about. We learn in the office to do this But you're doing it too. You may not have been paying attention, but people make you feel certain ways. Some people make you feel insecure. Other people make you feel like top of the world. You have all sorts of reactions. So learn to listen to how people make you feel, and particularly learn to listen to how psychopaths, sociopaths, and narcissists make you feel, so that when you meet someone new, you can know whether or not they're tipping off those bells for you and making you feel really insecure. So that's about the victim myth, the fact that the victim myth is this weak, insecure, broken woman who moves from broken relationship to broken relationship. It's based on observation over 30 plus years ago in shelters. It's not based on research, and it's not accurate. So I hope that helps explain or clear up some things. And if you're finding yourself having some reaction to that, that may be a place for you to look in. Why is that setting you off? It may give you insight into that. Because here's the other thing that we're not talking about that's super powerful and that kind of helps me segue into cognitive dissonance. Why then are really sharp, smart people falling prey to this group of people? Why? What's happening? And we're not really talking much about it. We say love bombing. Yeah, the love bombing is really amazing and it's over the top and it's super compelling, and it's actually using intermittent reinforcement, which is the most addictive form of reinforcement. They've actually done studies of that. Rats will starve to death over intermittent reinforcement. So that's why you can't leave the slot machine. That's why it's hard for you to get off of a video game when you're playing it. They are using intermittent reinforcement. It's very, very compelling. But what else is going on? Well, here's the thing, and this is fascinating. They're using the same techniques as cult leaders do. Sandra Brown refers to it as hypnotic mind control. They're using hypnotic mind control. They're doing it various ways. They're using the eye gazing, the intensity of that, what they're sharing, how they're sharing it, their proximity. My ex used to do a lot of touching, physical touching of a person's arm and the woman's arm. They're mirroring you. They're parroting you. They're doing all sorts of these things. And here's the wild thing. Every relationship they burn through that doesn't go well, doesn't succeed, they learn and then improve, learn and improve. In fact, if you watch Raw Motivations material, Ben Taylor, he says the same thing. He's a self-aware narcissist. That's what he said. He said whenever a relationship would fail, he would take whatever it was he didn't do well with the last one, and then he would improve it so he was better the next time. Sandra Brown said that by the age of 30, these men, that's who she's looking at, that's why I'm being gender specific, the men she was working at with and knew were better trained and more sophisticated at hypnotic mind control than pedophiles. Better than pedophiles. So it's actually, it's a tactic, a technique that, and Don Hennessy in his book, How He Gets Into Her Head, great book, highly recommend it. Don Hennessy is part of the Irish Law Enforcement Task Force looking at domestic violence, said that these people who do this are so sophisticated at it that if you meet them and you meet a good enough one, you won't be able to resist. He said, don't get on your high horse and think that you have reasons to be proud, that you're all above that and that can't happen to you. He said, if it has not happened to you, it's been because of luck and you've not met a sophisticated enough perpetrator. Wow. Mind-blowing, isn't it? And then we want to victim blame. We want to say, it's all their fault. Meanwhile, we're not really doing more looking at what's happening. How are people being trained to be this good at it? How do we help the population be safe from individuals who are this sophisticated? We're not looking at those issues. I find that intriguing why we're not addressing that. Are you aware that I have other social media platforms? I have short form videos on TikTok and Instagram, as well as posts on Instagram, and then longer form on YouTube. Recently, I just posted a blind reaction video to TLC's hit show, Unexpected. Be sure to check it out and let me know what you think. You can find me across most platforms at the handle of Carrie McAvoy, PhD. That brings me into the cognitive dissonance. When you've been love bombed and you think you really met the real person in the love bombing, you don't know that what you heard was all a lie. And so you believe the words, despite the fact the behavior doesn't line up, and it creates this state of confusion in your head so that you literally are living in a duality, two different worlds. This person's treating me horrible. People who treat me horrible don't love me. They're abusive. That's existing. At the same time, he says he loves me. He does nice things to me sometimes. And then when something really bad goes wrong, he tries to make up and then he works really hard. See, that's the good. And they live side by side and create the state of confusion. And then that state of confusion paralyzes you and makes you unable to leave. You literally are frozen. You're frozen. For those who've never been in that state, it's agonizing. It's agonizing. There's some examples. I'm seeing it on TV and some shows that are doing a wonderful job at showing it in other settings. So if you've watched the whole series of Ozark, the kids' paralysis to stay, especially the season three and four, when grandpa wants to take them away, those kids are experiencing cognitive dissonance. Even at the end, the way Ozark leaves you with Jonah, that's a profound picture of cognitive dissonance. Their inability to leave the cartel, despite knowing the cartel is ruthless and killing people and they're not safe, that's cognitive dissonance, the inability to make a decision. I'm trying to think that there's another show. I've been watching Good Moms. I know it's an older series. Good Moms, all the way through, is a prime example of cognitive dissonance. These women can't make a decision to stay or go when they're caught in with this gang group, you know, forging money, you know, laundering money. And they're also, what's the word when you create your forgeries? They're creating forgeries. The whole thing is an example of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance in itself is not a problem. It actually helps us make changes, helps us assess whether or not we're doing the kind making decisions we should be making. It's a normal thing. But what happens with narcissistic abusive relationships in particular is that the relationship from the beginning is actually deceptive. It's deceptive. You don't know that you're not meeting a real person. You think you've met this really great woman or man. They present like you. You think you've met your match. You don't know that this is a person who's come into this relationship not intentionally, purposely trying to be hurtful. But they really want, because they're broken, because of their disorder, they really want you to like them a lot. And so they're now creating a mask to match you, to fit you, so that you'll like them. And so that then you'll be supply for them. By the way, the reason we use the word supply is because these individuals, okay, we all have needs. We all need to be loved, feel safe, be admired, know we have worth. That's called healthy narcissism. Now, how do we get that? Well, when you're little, you get it from your mom and dad. They love on you. They count your toes. They kiss you. They think your poop doesn't stink. They think you're amazing. But as you get older, where does it come from? Well, hopefully you've learned to do this for yourself. You've learned to give yourself affirmations and to work through failures and to process life's difficulties. You figured out how to take on the job yourself. That's what emotional maturity looks like. Now, unfortunately, not all of us get there. And the more back you are into not able to do this for yourself, the more disordered you are. So narcissists and sociopaths, what they're doing is they're getting it, instead of doing it from themselves, they're getting it from those around them. And they want you to regulate their emotions. When they have a fit, you're supposed to calm them down or not trigger them. When they're bored, you're supposed to entertain them. When they don't feel super worthy or have insecurity, you're supposed to shore them up and show them all this admiration and love and pour into them. They're like literally like a black hole. You're just filling them and filling them and filling them. But the problem is, because of their disorder and the way that their mind works, they're insatiable. There's never enough. And so it literally like pours through them. They have what's called low receptive capacity. It's like a sieve or a colander. So your support, your resources, your assets, whatever you give them, pours through, just like a colander. The water's pouring through. With that, it pours through them. So you have to give more and more and more, and it never ends. They need more and more. So instead of learning how to do this for themselves, they use you to do it for them. And that's why you're the supply. In a perfect world, they would do it for themselves. In a perfect world, you're doing it for yourselves. Dr. David Snarf, in his book, The Passionate Marriage, calls this borrowed functioning. They're borrowing their functioning from you. They're leaning into you for support. Now, we all do this a little bit. When we're not growing up, very emotionally mature, we all do this a little bit. The more mature we are, the more we don't do it, the more we learn how to take our insecure, those bad moments we're having, instead of saying, does this make me look fat? We learn how to say to ourselves, I'm okay. Even if I do look a little heavy in this outfit, I'm okay. See, that's that when we do that, that's when we're not borrowing so much from someone else to make us feel better. So whenever you kind of lean into someone for support in a way like to reassure you, that's your borrowing functioning at that moment. You know, you're like, I don't know if I should do this. What do you think? That's borrowing function from a friend when you do that. Is it bad? No, it's not bad. But in a perfect world, you learn how to do this for yourself. The more you can't do it for yourself, the more you're going to be leaning into everyone around you and then using people to do this for you. And the more you're not really going to be appreciative of them having their needs and creating space for them. That then makes you fall further down the line, closer to narcissism, borderline personality traits, or any something like that. So that gives you a sense of what's going on with them and why they're a little bit different. But yes, cognitive dissonance, this long-term kind of stress on our mental space does cause trauma and damage. We're not meant to be in this place of indecisiveness for days, months, years. We're not meant to. And as a result, your hippocampus shrinks, which is where your emotional regulation, your sense of how you feel about yourself, how you feel about life, shrinks. So you start to feel more confused. You start to get more forgetful. The amygdala, which is your alarm state, actually swells. And this is where you feel kind of on alert. You can't sleep. You're always, you know, feeling on guard. You're waiting for the shoe to drop. You're jumpy. That's swelling. And then you have sort of decreased mental functioning in your prefrontal cortex. So you just feel like you're not as sharp as you used to. And it's, by the way, it's all real. It's not in your mind. It's actually happening. And it's observable on a functional EEG. How do you resolve the cognitive dissonance? Well, let's talk about that. How do you resolve this duality? The hard part is we have to do some grief work. You have to begin to realize the person you met, you thought you met, you didn't meet. I likened it because I had just lost a spouse of 31 years. It felt like I had to accept that the partner I met on those first dates had died. That's the way I framed it to help myself. That he, maybe you could even say he never or she never existed. That you met a mask. You didn't meet. See, we end up feeling like we're living with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. or Ms. Hyde, and we don't know which is real. So we live in this state of limbo. We really hope Dr. Jekyll's real, but so we keep leaning into that direction, but we're living with Mr. and Mrs. Hyde more and more and more of the time. But we can't leave because we can't figure out what's true, what's accurate. The way to do this is to resolve the bind, to resolve the duality. And it means you have to decide which is real. I kept leaning in the direction that the guy I met, the good guy, was the real guy. I didn't want to believe that the monster that I kept seeing was actually the real guy. I didn't want to believe that. By the way, I had a moment where I told him this. I said to him, I said, I thought that I met a good guy who sometimes wear a monster mask, but what I'm realizing is I've actually met a monster who wears a good guy mask. He turned gray. He leaned forward and said, I'm glad you know. You have met a monster. Unfortunately, people who are ill with these diseases, who don't get help, who don't become responsible and stop the whole lineage of abuse, is monstrous. We are responsible for our behavior. So we have to give up the fantasy of the good guy and the wonderful woman. We have to give these fantasies up in order for us to heal and get ready to leave. Otherwise, we'll stay in this state of limbo of never really for sure knowing what is real. I'll tell you, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. At first, I didn't want to believe it. I had to keep re-saying this to myself. Watch what he does, ignore what he says. What he does is what's real. What he does is he's cheating. He's saying out loud to me, I don't know why I don't find my wife attractive. He's not interested in me. He's not checking out how my day. He's critical of me. He's defensive when I bring something up. He stonewalls and walks out. He's contemptuous and puts me down. This stuff doesn't speak love. Love doesn't look like this. Doesn't look like this. I had to keep saying this to myself over and over and over. And believe it or not, that actually works. They have research on it. I know psychologists and sociologists will research the most idiotic stuff sometimes. They asked, does it work just to sort of see that? And does it make a difference over time? And the answer they found was, yes, it does. You don't have to believe it. Just you seeing it repetitively. That, by the way, they do that in the music industry, does that. Have you ever noticed a popular song will come out and play on the air? And at first you're like, I don't know if I like that song. You know? But then they keep playing it over and over and over. And by the 100th time, you're like, hey, I kind of like this song. They have found the same principle works. That repetition helps you to shift your mindset. And familiarity causes it to become real for you and likable for you. So you don't need to believe it. I'm not asking you to believe it. Just write it down and every day look at it. And just the act of looking at it will help you to let the truth sink into your heart and sink into your mind. The other thing is begin to stop looking for this person to be your support. And I know that when I'm telling you this, I'm actually telling you, I'm telling you that you need to let the relationship die, because the opposite of love is not hatred. That's actually emotional fusion. Again, Dr. David Snarf talks about this in his book, The Passionate Marriage. Fusion is when we really are bound to someone in an intense way. We can need them, and we also, at the same time, we sometimes hate them or am angry with them. That's a fuse. We're in a fused state. We're always preoccupied with them. You'll notice your mindset is constantly about this person. That's a preoccupation, shows you the fusion. The actual real opposite of love is apathy or indifference. It's detachment. It's ceasing to care. Their opinion ceases to matter. For me, I had to say to myself, I don't need his opinion on this. I can figure this out myself. Or why am I looking for him for his approval? Can I do that for myself? Or when he gets really upset and says something that's super stupid or wrong, why do I correct it? I don't need to correct it. It's just his belief and it doesn't make it true just because he says that. I had to do all these types of things to help me get boundaries around my emotions and for me to detach from this person to stop being invested in them. I had to emotionally de-invest, stop being invested. So I'd highly recommend that you practice that. Find other people to function that way. But I'm not talking about romantically. I'm not advocating that you jump into new supply too. I'm just advocating lean into your friends and learn to do this for yourself. But see, this is not good marital advice. If I was telling you how to strengthen a marriage, this is the absolute opposite. I'm actually telling you how to finish destroying a marriage. Well, it's already being destroyed. I'm just telling you how to get out, extricate yourself from it. So that's another thing that really helps is to emotionally detach. If you're a good parent, right? And you have a kid come home and he tells you or she tells you something's really going wrong and what you're doing is not helping, it's making it worse, but could you do this instead? If you said, nah, sorry, I'm not going to do it. I don't really care. I want to do it my way. Would we say that's a good parent? No, we'd say that's bad parenting, right? Why then is it okay for a spouse to do that or a partner to do that? It's not. That's not good. That's not good help. That's not love showing care. That's apathy and cruelty. That's meanness. That's not having your back. This person should have your back. So for you to begin to really kind of challenge yourself, I remember what really hit me and it was a big turning point. I watched the show Quiet Place, the movie Quiet Place. And I think Emily Blunt played the woman, and I'm trying to remember, it's her husband in real life played opposite. Joe, you know, the guy from Office. They're married. They love each other. And there's a scene in the movie where they're dancing in the floor in the quiet, and you can tell this couple truly loves each other. I mean, really loves each other. And I'm watching this scene, and it hits me. My partner, my husband's never felt this way for me. I've never seen this look on his face for me like this. And then I asked myself, how did I miss that? Why didn't I see this earlier? But that was, for me, was the start of me putting it together and detaching. So those things will help you get ready to leave, to resolve the cognitive dissonance. And as you do it, you'll grieve the fact that Dr. Jekyll never existed. You'll really come to terms with the fact that you're with Ms. or Mr. Hyde. And as all that sort of settles in, then that will help you to again take action for you to be able to leave. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. Have you bought your ticket for the live interview with Dr. Kristen Milston on August 18th? This is going to be a super helpful evening, jam-packed with information on things like resolving a trauma bond, explaining what keeps us emotionally stuck in toxic relationships and why we find it so hard to leave. And when we're out, why do we feel so preoccupied with these relationships? I remember being in the midst of that last toxic relationship and I was desperate for information. I wish a seminar like this existed then. If I had had information like this, I would have known that I wasn't going to be able to fix my narcissistic husband or our toxic relationship. And that in fact, it was damaging for me to stay. So don't wait. Space is limited. Get your tickets in the show notes. Replay are free to all ticket holders. So if you missed that evening, you'll still get access to the helpful information. I can't wait to see you at the webinar, and until next Monday, bye-bye.